Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
The FIFA Women's World Cup is only 6 weeks away. It's being held here in Australia and New Zealand. Demand for tickets has been red hot. I wonder if you're going. I mentioned this earlier and Jenny in Point Lonsdale said, yeah, I've written off all of July. I'll be watching the Women's Cup during the day and then I'll be watching the Tour de France at night. Jeez, Jenny, you're not going to be getting any sleep, are you? I know we're going to get a chance to see Sam Kerr in action. And with these sellout crowds, it's going to feel like women's sport here in Australia is going to have perhaps its greatest moment yet. It's kind of easy to forget, or if you're a bit younger, you might not even realise, that the days when Australia's female soccer players had to wash their undies in the sink when on tour because they couldn't afford the laundry aren't actually that far behind us. The first official Women's World Cup was held in 1991 after much agitation from women players around the world who wanted their own event. But the women who took part had to pay for their own flights and often had to give up their jobs to take part. Things have certainly changed. Fiona Crawford is my guest. Fiona's a writer who's previously co-authored Never Say Die, the 100-year overnight success of Australian women's football. And she's got a new book out called The Matilda Effect. Hello, Fiona.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So how many matches will you be seeing at the upcoming World Cup?
Look, I have to confess, I'm actually both a football fan and a mad keen cyclist. So my July is going to look very similar to your listeners in there's going to be a lot of football and a lot of cycling and not a lot of sleep.
Yeah. Wait, what's your sense going into this World Cup, Fiona, about how much enthusiasm and awareness there is about it?
Look, I don't think Australia and New Zealand quite know what's going to hit them. I've had the privilege of working with the Matildas as their social media manager at times, and I've written about them for years for various publications. I went with them to the 2011 tournament where they were really starting to almost break through, but it was very early days for social media and you couldn't see all of the games, so all the fans couldn't quite follow it as closely here in Australia. But I can tell you that being in Germany in 2011, it was just an incredible World Cup. I then went to 2019 in France and I didn't think that, you know, you could top 2011, but wow, it really kicked it to another level. So 2023, off the back of a year where women's sport, and particularly women's football, has broken all sorts of crowd records, all sorts of ticket sale records, it's really going to be another level again.
And I am going to say soccer, just so it's clear to everybody who's, you know, we've got our AFL states, our NRL states. I know you'll say football. I'll just say soccer, just so we're all clear. It'd be good if we could just get on the same page as the rest of the world. But
it really would. Either is fine with me. As long as it's clear, I don't mind.
Now, the title of your book is The Matilda Effect. It's a very nice play on words because while it's clearly about the Matildas, there is actually something called The Matilda Effect. Explain what that is.
There is. So I actually had come up with the title originally because I was thinking about the really remarkable effect that the Matildas had had on women's sport and gender equality because they are playing the only truly world game. When something moves with them in terms of, for example, achieving pay parity, it actually moves. It's quite a seismic shift and it affects all the other women's sports. And when I came up with that title, I Googled it, obviously, to see, you know, what else was around. And I discovered quite by chance that there's actually a scientific concept called the Matilda Effect. And I didn't know this because I don't have a background in science. But basically, it's a phenomenon of women's scientific contributions being overlooked or omitted or misattributed to the nearest male. And although it's firmly embedded in science, I thought, hang on, those are actually principles and experiences that are very recognisable in women's sport.
Well, you point to, I think, the Socceroos winning the Asian Cup and claiming they were the first Australian team to do so, and a whole lot of women putting up their hands and going, yeah.
Yeah, that was exactly one of those moments. It was a really wonderful moment to see the Socceroos win, but that happened in 2015, and the Matildas had actually already won the Asian Cup themselves. They'd done it 5 years earlier in 2010, but that's, I think, the classic, you know, sports history really has a bias towards men. And it's not that there was, it wasn't the Socceroos themselves who were saying it, but really, it was really fantastic actually to see some women sports advocates quickly jumping online and fixing that headline just to try to educate the public a little bit. And the media as well.
Yeah. Fiona Crawford is the author of The Matilda Effect. And as Fiona was just explaining, she's been part of the Matilda's social media team and sort of been with them at the various World Cups. So you say in the introduction to the book that for a long time, many young female soccer players didn't even know there was a national women's team or a women's World Cup. When did the Matildas actually begin?
So they began about 40 years ago. The first official documented women's football game that was played in Australia was actually played at the Gabba. It was an exhibition match, and that was 1921. But really, there wasn't a lot of funding or a lot of support for it anytime after that. And it was there was a women's football association run by some really dedicated women, including Heather Reid, and names you would recognise as some of the greats of the game these days. And they were organising competitions. They were taking teams, selecting national teams and taking them overseas. But it took until sort of the late 70s for the Matildas, as we know them, to really start to form and to play some trans-Tasman matches against New Zealand. And then it took until 1988 for FIFA to give women. It was a pilot World Cup. It wasn't even an official World Cup. They sort of gave us a test World Cup to see if we were worth it.
Right. And presumably the women passed the first hurdle there. What was Australia's team like back in 1988?
Look, they were fantastic, and they were some of the so essentially they were all working other jobs, and they only got together once or twice a year. So they converged about a week before the tournament. They had even the coach had to take some time off work to go train with them. They all sort of met each other, played for a little bit, and then headed overseas to meet these teams they'd never actually played before. The first team they actually encountered was Brazil, which is, as you know, Brazil has a pretty formidable football reputation. So it was not a small match to be taking on as their first one. And it was actually the first match that was ever played, because it wasn't the official opening match, but it kicked off. They kicked off earlier in the day. So the Australians kicked the first ball of the first official FIFA Women's World Cup.
All right there at the start of the history of it. Amazing. So you mentioned, you know, people were taking time off work. So if you were in the Matildas in these very early days, how did you juggle being a Matilda and everything else you had to do in your life?
Oh, so much. They were doing all sorts of fundraising. So there were Lamington Drives. They ran some casino nights. Moya Dodd, who you'd recognise as probably, she was named one of the most powerful women in sport in recent years, but at the time she was a judge's associate. She skipped her university graduation and worked extra time so that while the other people went to their graduation, so that she could take a little bit of extra time off to go represent Australia. And she still got docked, you know, from her pay to do that. Julie Dolan, who's the inaugural captain, she actually had to leave jobs because she couldn't, they couldn't backfill her, and they weren't going to support her while she was away.
So did they get paid at all for being part of the Matildas back then?
No. And even to attend that first tournament in 1988, they actually had to pay about $850. So Moya Dodd, famously, because she was on such a low salary at the time, was allowed to pay in two instalments. So she paid $400 in one instalment and $450 in the next. They really did. They even couldn't keep their uniforms because they were part of the official kit and they had to be part of the stock take each year. So they've got very little in terms of footage or memorabilia from that time. And pretty, pretty tough times for all of them.
I mean, there are some stories you tell. I'm not sure if it's maybe the 1991 one where you talk about the women having to sew badges on the uniforms and make alterations to the kit because it wasn't measured for. It was just whatever you could get.
Absolutely. It took until the 2019 Women's World Cup. So we're talking in the last couple of years for them to actually get a women's specific kit. And that's why it was such a big deal when it came out. It was kind of that, it looked a little bit like the Socceroos' infamous Spew jersey, where it's had this like real, really hectic pattern of like splotches of paint. But it was a really big deal because back in, from 1988 all the way through, they'd been wearing men's kits, which were much too big, much too long, and they really were having to, you know, sew up the hems. They were having to, you know, roll up the sleeves or cut off the sleeves at times. It was not a comfortable kit for them to be playing in.
Fiona, you also do tell a story about them trying to take the kit with them at one point and getting in some trouble for that. Tell us what happened.
It is. So they, and interestingly, one of the coach or the coaches were actually on board with it as well, because they did feel sorry for them, because the players really did want to keep some of the kit as a memento. There's some conjecture about whether it was the jerseys or the shorts. I've heard different versions of the story, but essentially, and it looks like it was maybe the New South Wales players who did it, but they went and took a bit of the kit and put it on everybody's bed. And the thinking behind it was that if everybody had a bit of the kit, no one would dob them in. Of course, you know, that was, the kit was noted to be missing. So everyone was ordered to open their bags, and there was a bit of grumbling, and they had to kind of hand back the kit. But the flag did actually go missing. There was a flag that they'd made, which cost more than $100, which was a lot back in the 80s. And that to this day remains missing. So it's, I think it's, you know, some in somebody's garage or somebody's memorabilia.
And someone's still,
it's a
not
well-kept secret.
Yeah, still not willing to fess up that they were the one who took it.
No.
Fiona Crawford is here, author of a book called The Matilda Effect, and we're talking about the history of the Matildas, because, of course, it's only 6 weeks or so, I think, until the Women's World Cup comes to Australia and also New Zealand. Now, it was really important, Fiona, wasn't it? You said that first one was sort of a test to go, look, is this going to work, or is anyone going to watch? But it was really important for women's soccer to become an Olympic sport, wasn't it?
It really was. And I didn't actually understand this until I was researching the book. And it was the administrators, Maria Berry and Heather Reid, who really emphasised this point with me. Essentially, when the Women's World Cup started out, they were really small and they didn't have much funding. So the Olympics were much more esteemed and they had a lot more funding tied to them. So in order to do well for the Women's World Cup, they actually needed to leverage off the Olympics. So when they were at the 1991 World Cup, they actually were lobbying to get women's football into the Olympics, because the moment that happened, then suddenly it opened up funding for the women's football team. And that's how the Australians actually got, funding for, they had like a year-long program at the Australian Institute of Sport leading into the 2000 Olympics that we had in Sydney. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had that.
There was an interesting idea you talk about, that when it, you know, are we watching women's soccer or men's soccer? And people go, oh, I don't know if I want to watch the women's. But when it comes to the Olympics, it doesn't really matter, because you're just watching Australians.
Yeah, and there's actual research that supports it. It's called gender blindness, and that's really what it is. You are supporting your national team, and the gender really doesn't come into it. So it is a crucial attitudinal change as well that comes from it. So, yeah, the Olympics are really, really powerful.
So how did they come to be called the Matildas?
There was a competition that the SBS ran for them back in 1995, and it was quite interesting. It was strategic, because the team wasn't well known. They were known as the Australian Women's Football Team, and the players themselves would tell you they'd be travelling through airports and they'd be, you know, wearing their kit or their uniforms, and people would say to them, oh, you know, what team are you? And they say, oh, we're the Australian National Women's Football Team. And people say, oh, do we have a team? We had no idea. So it was all about raising the profile of the team. The players and the staff didn't know a huge amount about it. And some of the names that were sort of bandied about as part of the competition were a little bit silly. Like, I think one of them was called Laura Keats or something like that. So the players were a bit nervous, thinking, oh, I don't know if we want to be called that. But when the Matildas were successful, it's actually become one of the most iconic names for Australian football teams or Australian sporting teams, male or female. So it's been a really great success.
Let's talk about 1999. This is when the World Cup was held in the US. And this was amazing, really, because the US went all out to host an incredible tournament. And they had a lot of spectators too, didn't they?
Yeah, the Americans went big, and they actually showed for the first time just how big women's football could be. It kind of was a bit of a standalone event, because things dissipated pretty quickly after that. But I think it actually is the first hint of what 2023 is going to be like for us. But yeah, the Americans went all out. They were selling out stadiums. They had Bill Clinton there. Jennifer Lopez was doing singing Let's Get Loud. I think NSYNC and Justin Timberlake were there performing. They had flyovers from jets. There was all sorts of stuff. And they really did get, I think until recently, they had the record crowd for women's football. And it was 90,185 or something huge. It was in the Rose Bowl in Pasadena.
Now, here's a bizarre story from that year. The Matildas played a three-game tour of North Korea as a warm-up, which I can't imagine would fly now, but presumably it must have been a much more palatable proposition back in 99.
Well, actually, it wasn't. So the Australian government warned them and not to go. They were sort of on their own with it. But so there was a little bit of media coverage, mostly because they were ignoring the government advice to go. And it's the kind of these trips are ones that pretty much every player you speak to will mention North Korea, because it was such an otherworldly experience to fly in. You know, they were really in a bubble and they saw a part of the world that I think most of us will never, ever see. They tell stories of, you know, knowingly, or they could hear noises in the walls because they actually felt they could tell that they were being monitored. When they went to visit a statue of the leader at the time, you know, they were told they couldn't turn their back to the statue because that would be disrespectful. There were people who were trimming the grass at the stadium with scissors, or there were a pair of goats who were, there were actual goats and people with scissors. It was something like that I think the rest of us will just never experience or never quite be able to comprehend.
And what were the actual games like?
Oh, very biased. They were never really going to win them. So we do know, for example, Julie Murray, who's a former Matildas captain and a striker, one of our best. It didn't matter what position she started from. She was always apparently offside. I know there was a game in particular where I think the games are supposed to be 90 minutes long, but it seemed to keep going a lot longer than 90 minutes until North Korea did actually score. And then remarkably, the game did finish. So that was,
And they ended up with kind of bruises from being pinched by the other team.
And I've seen that even in recent tournaments as well. It is a strategy, which is a bit of a sad one, but the North Korean players do actually pinch, like your really sensitive skin around your, for example, around your ribs or on your arms, and they do squeal in your ears as well, which is pretty hard to hear for 90 minutes straight. So, yeah, it's one of the tactics that they use. I wouldn't condone it, but you know, we also don't know the circumstances under which they're training and playing.
Well, exactly. And you'd imagine these North Koreans, if they'd lost those games, which didn't seem like it was a possibility from the way you described it, but what the consequences might have been, as you say, for those players. Fiona Crawford is here, author of The Matilda Effect. So we're more or less at sort of 99, 2000 now. And Dennis from Greenpoint just rang in, actually, Fiona, to say he's got a copy of the Matildas nude calendar from about 30 years ago. And I was going to ask about that because, I mean, this is symptomatic of what's going on. They're going to this World Cup, but they still are not getting compensated in a way that means that they don't have to resort to something like a nude calendar.
Yeah, and I have complicated feelings about the calendar because it's the kind of thing that 12 players participated and at the time, and they still maintain to this day that they don't regret participating in it. And look, hats off to them if they felt they were fit, they felt confident in their bodies. It was an opportunity to earn some money, and look, they stand by it and I do support that. I think where my complicated feelings come in is that, as you said, they weren't getting paid enough and they were also quite young. You know, when you're in your late teens, early 20s, you think you're pretty worldly, but I think you don't quite understand that there's a whole level of scrutiny and cultural baggage that comes with or that's applied to women. So I think having to get nude doesn't necessarily earn you the respect, and it certainly didn't earn them the money that they needed to really, you know, turn it into a professional pursuit.
And did people end up talking about that calendar for years and not sort of wanting to let that go as their big story about the Matildas?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the kind of thing that, you know, 12 players participated, but I feel like it's a baggage that still sort of hangs around the team. The good thing I can take from it is in recent years, there's been much less talk of the calendar because there's been so many other amazing achievements by the team that, yeah, the calendar's kind of in the rearview mirror.
Yeah. Now, I didn't realise this, Fiona, but Australia had previously bid to host the Women's World Cup in 2003, but we missed out, and you say that whole cup was a story of lost opportunities.
Yes, 2003 is wild, and I didn't know much of this myself until recently. So two really big things happened. It was the year that we could and should have been hosting a Women's World Cup, and it's also the year that the Australian Women's Soccer Association, so the governing body that was running the Matildas, actually went bankrupt. And so the backstory to it is that the The AWSA was bidding for the 2003 World Cup, and they were literally the only bidder. There was no other bidder in the process, because women's World Cups weren't that esteemed at that stage. So everyone was sort of preemptively congratulating them, saying, look, we'll see you in Australia in 2003, you know, really looking forward to it. But as so often happens in women's sport, men's sport politics kind of overshadowed it. And the Chinese delegation had bid for a men's youth cup, and they hadn't been successful, and they were really, really unhappy. So what happened was FIFA just said, oh, well, you can have the Women's World Cup as a consolation prize. And so it was actually quite offensive, because, you know, the Chinese delegates didn't want the Women's World Cup, and the Australians who'd bid for it and who were the only bidders didn't get it. So they actually were going to send it to China for 2003, but as we know, SARS happened. The SARS pandemic happened in 2003, so it actually got moved back to the US at the last minute. So Australia missed out a second time, because they would have put their hands up, but FIFA decided, well, because the US had hosted it in 1999, you know, they were probably best placed to resurrect that sort of setup and at short notice. But then also what happened later in that year was, and it was partly related to funding around the calendar and legal advice that was had not been paid, the AWSA actually went bankrupt. And it was discovered by one of the Matildas, because as she worked in her day job as a lawyer, she went to court and looked at, you know, the list of all the cases that were being heard that day, and happened to notice that there were winding up proceedings that were happening for her association that was running the Matildas. And so she called the board in a panic, saying, what's going on? And it was actually the first that they knew about it, because they had not been informed by the male administrators about the true state of the financial affairs of the club or of the association. So yeah, it was a year when we could have been hosting the most esteemed women's football event. And it was also a year that the organisation that ran the Matildas went bankrupt.
Yeah. Well, this year we'll go, yeah, this is the one that's 20 years later than it should have been. It's just incredible looking back on some of these stories. So I want to jump now to 2015, because this is the year that the Matildas actually went on strike. What happened?
Yeah, there were two events that year that really bookended the tournament. So the first one was actually that FIFA announced that they were going to host the tournament and put it on artificial turf, which probably doesn't sound like much to people like me who, you know, aren't elite athletes. But when you've spent your entire career training on a particular surface and then you're asked to change to a different surface, and particularly when you're women and you are more prone to knee injuries, changing something as significant as a surface could actually be quite dangerous. So the players had actually had to protest that even before the tournament had kicked off, and they hadn't been successful in getting that change, so they had to play the tournament on this unfamiliar surface, which was very much, much hotter and had a different sort of grip and slip from that. And then afterwards, they essentially had to go on strike, because they were off contract, they were not being paid, their medical insurance was not being covered either, and they were being asked to go to the US to play two friendlies where they really couldn't actually afford to do it.
Wants to be without health insurance in the US, that's for sure.
No one does. And particularly if you're an elite athlete, and if you had a serious knee injury, that's you gone for a year or more. So it was so dire that players had actually, you know, put their things in storage, had moved back in with parents. They were really living sort of paycheck to paycheck, and they were reliant on even the meagre amount that they were earning at the time, which was about $20,000 if they were on contract. It was not a large amount of money, and it was actually in line with a Centrelink payment.
Yeah, it's certainly not a living, is it?
No, it really wasn't. So it also speaks a lot to the players who could play are the ones who were able to afford it, because they were being supported by their families or a partner. So there are also lots of players who just fell away from the game because they just couldn't afford it.
So what did the strike achieve then, Fiona?
Well, it actually forced, it drew attention, I think, to the seriousness of the issue, which is probably not well known to the general public. And it actually forced a little bit of, I wouldn't say huge increases in pay. It was in the vicinity of $30,000 or $40,000 at the time. So still not a huge amount. But by making that stand, they also made all of the other women's sports and all of the other administrators sort of sit up and go, oh, hang on, something shifted and women aren't going to accept this anymore. And it opened the door for some of the other codes such as netball and AFLW to really leverage that, and they've improved their own pay circumstances as well.
So what's the current state, Fiona? Are the Matildas earning something near the Socceroos or on par?
Yeah, well, in 2019, they achieved a groundbreaking pay parity deal. Interestingly, they actually achieved it the week I released my first book. So things were a little bit hectic, and it was a very exciting moment to have. My first book was almost immediately slightly out of date, but it was the best possible reason you could possibly imagine to have that happen. But yeah, they did. They signed a deal. The Socceroos actually really supported and negotiated with them and backed them, and they went in. And so it was, I don't know the exact figures, but they're earning, if they're in the top tier, in the vicinity of around $100,000 a year. But also more important than that, it's all the support services are also built in around. So for example, the Socceroos used to travel on business class, and the Matildas were traveling all over the world in economy and then having to perform, you know, the next day. They've got the same sort of strength and conditioning and recovery services around them as well. So these are the things that probably are not visible to the public, and it's a bit more than pay, but actually will enable them to perform really well and to extend their careers as well.
Fiona, we've just got a couple of minutes left. What kind of issues still remain when it comes to seeing women's soccer as truly equal to men's?
Oh, gosh. That's probably going to take more than a couple of minutes. Look, it still isn't where men's football is. If you imagine, we've only had a Women's World Cup since 1988. So prize money is probably the big one. And that's, so in 2019, quite famously at the final, there was a chant that was started. It was actually by an Australian. It was Kerry Harris, who's a really experienced football administrator and was one of those board members of the AWSA. But she started a chant that reverberated around the entire stadium for equal pay. So if you imagine, you know, tens of thousands of people chanting equal pay at FIFA. At the moment, the prize purse for the men's tournament is something mind-boggling, like $400 million. And the women's is, you know, we're talking 30. It's much, much lower.
Right. That's a rather massive discrepancy.
Yeah.
Fiona, we will have to wind it up as the news isn't too far away. How do you think we'll go very quickly in this World Cup?
Oh, look, I think we're going to ignite the nation. So regardless of the results, I think people are really going to sit up and pay attention to women's football.
Yeah, I absolutely can't wait. I'm sure you can't either. Thanks so much for being part of Nightlife tonight, Fiona.
Thank you.
Fiona Crawford is the author of The Matilda Effect.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.